Welcome to the Minimum Viable Podcast, a project of the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum. Our mission is to inspire, connect, and empower people in order to promote a culture of innovation in the U.S. national security community. You can learn more about DEF and get involved at DEF.org. That's DEF.org. We look forward to your ideas and are excited to connect you with other doers working on hard problems.
My name is Anthony Robbins, and I'm responsible for the public sector business for NVIDIA, a company I'm super proud of representing to the public sector in the federal marketplace, and a company whereby our GPUs and CUDA and software and frameworks are having an important role in a really important topic, that being artificial intelligence. And so today, we have assembled an esteemed panel of the Defense Entrepreneurs Board of Directors. It's a group overall that I've known for a long time. I have a massive amount of respect for, and they've got just terrific talent. I hope that as we deliver content via this panel, that you guys will get a sense for their experience and the ideas that they have about how we all can go faster as we support the largest technology transformation in the history of planet Earth, as I like to say. Or if we want to tone that down a little bit, we could say, as we support the largest tech transformation that the federal government has ever undertaken. And so to manage introductions, I'm just going to go through and introduce you to the DEF Board of Directors, and then we'll go ahead and get started. Jen Savada is a dear friend who I think is one of the class acts on the Beltway. She's a senior vice president of Avantis Federal. She's responsible for building out technical intel business for them. She's been a DEF board member since 2016. And in 2019, she was named by Forbes as one of the top 50 AI influencers in government. She recently retired from a distinguished career in the Air Force. Jen, I believe it was 25 years. That's from memory. And so, Jen, thank you for joining our board today. Josh Marcuse, you know, oftentimes you'll hear people say, I don't know if he needs an introduction. I actually don't know if Josh needs an introduction. I've known Josh for several years now. He has played an instrumental role in a lot of the work that's going on across the Department of Defense with respect to AI. He played that role a lot as the executive director of the DIB, a role that he had before joining Google, where he's the head of strategy and innovation. He's got a quick wit, a quick mind, and is very focused on everything to do with innovation and technology and defense and national strategy. If you look at his LinkedIn profile, you'll see something that summarizes him quite well: pushing the boundaries at the intersection of tech, innovation, national security, and public service. He gives graciously to our community, and I think we're all better because of his contribution. I don't see Megan. Is Megan with us today? I don't see her in the panel.
Here.
Oh, there you are, Megan. Okay, the CEO of Decode. You know, here's how I would describe Megan, separate from what you see in LinkedIn or bios and the like. And it's really interesting as it relates to technology. So she'll say about herself, she loves shiny new tech and developing creative ways to improve government with them. What we often say is that the technology transformation that's occurring right now in artificial intelligence has very little to do with technology. And it has a lot to do with leading change and transformation. And of course, we all know the business of government happens to be the most complex business in the world. And so what we have to do as an organization, as a community, is we have to lead change and transformation. And Megan has a reputation for being excellent in a really challenging area, and that is leading change and transformation across the government, whether it's the business of government or bringing technology into the government. And I'm pleased to have her contribution on our panel today. Chris Lynch, speed comes to mind when I think about Chris. He's the CEO of Rebellion Defense. Many of you guys have heard about and read about them. He fancies himself as an entrepreneur and a tech geek. I like, you know, one of the other things I was able to scrape from the internet, he's a regular lecturer at Stanford's computer science department, encouraging nerds to serve in government. But he was also previously a founding director of the Defense Digital Service. He's served three Secretary of Defenses, and he's got a company today that's critically focused on developing software in and around artificial intelligence to support the Department of Defense and national security. A lot of talent. So Chris, thank you. And I'm going to thank you in advance for the sense of humor that the audience is sure to get today. Ivana, I was told earlier today that this might be one of the few times that we're going to see her on video. She's a CEO and technologist of Omelas Technology. Her focus has generally been on technology policy and security. A lot of focus on artificial intelligence. She's also has a role as a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security. She's also founded two other technology ventures, along with a lot of other accomplishments in her brilliant career. Ian, is it true that at the moment you're the only enlisted officer on this panel? And so, sir, all I have to say is you got your work cut out for you.
It's been fun.
Yeah, to represent. But Ian is the senior enlisted leader for Air Force Strategic Studies Group, and he's new in that role, having recently moved from West Coast to East Coast. Correct, Ian?
That's right, Anthony.
Yep. And in his role, he's focused on optimizing at the edge acquisition, commercial business development, integration with academia, venture capital, kind of in the light. So he's known in our industry and community as, like Megan, as a change agent and with courage and not scared to take risks. Joy, you know, there's a lot to say about Joy. In her LinkedIn profile, she calls out asset guardian, ruthless strategist, defense advisor, and CEO of the Boone Group. Something about the Boone Group is really cool. It was her grandmother's restaurant that was flipped into a munitions production line in Detroit back during World War II. She has done some really interesting work around gang violence investigation. And we had hoped to have this as a live panel, and we're going to use Joy to help me control some of the panelists. And I won't call Josh out by name, but Joy was also an amateur boxer for USA Boxing with an undefeated record. And I had in my mind that she was going to help me control Josh and perhaps others if they were going to get a little bit out of control as we lead this panel. So listen, you know, after 30 years of being in this business, it's just actually a privilege to serve this community at the intersection of the greatest technology transformation our customer has ever faced. And it's a giant team sport. We need to do better and go faster. We're doing some things actually really well. And so what we thought we would do with this panel is just get started. And Josh, I'm actually going to start with you because you promised me that you were going to be the shortest in your response. And so the idea is we're just going to give this our esteemed panelist a platform for a minute or two, Josh, maybe 3 minutes in your case or less, to tell the audience what keeps you up at night or what you're inspired about with respect to artificial intelligence and our service to this opportunity.
All right, I brought a prop. Like I'm really going to do this real quick. Okay, so first, reprising one of our refrains from the Defense Innovation Board, something we said all the time that I think applies to AI as much as anything else is, DoD does not have an innovation problem. It has an innovation adoption problem. And I think this is really true for AI. I mean, companies like NVIDIA, companies like mine at Google, and I'm here speaking for DEF and not for Google. And I want to say that, you know, to Ted, my head of public relations, again, like if you're listening, I'm not speaking for Google, I'm speaking for DEF. But companies like Google and Amazon and Microsoft and others and Rebellion, all these companies, right? They're doing amazing things with artificial intelligence every day. The challenge for DoD is adoption at scale. And we really have to think about how to get organized for helping them know how to be a savvy consumer of these things. That's number one. You know, you're really thinking about DoD not as a researcher of AI, as a customer of machine learning products, services, commercial offerings. Second, trust, which was a huge part of the work that we did with Yudi on writing a report for the Secretary of Defense on AI ethics guidelines, but going beyond that and thinking about the frontier of T&E, testing and thinking about how to make sure we understand what are the right acceptable levels of risk and variation and certainty that we need for certain missions where we have to be completely certain, and other missions where actually just assisting or automating a process is actually not a safety issue. It's not a critical issue. It just gives us the ability to accelerate on time or save resources, and being really thoughtful about applying the right benchmarks to the right questions. And then last, I think the important thing is also is really understanding what are the things that are commodity and what are the things that are unique to the military. And I think it's so important that the department really think about what are the things that they need to trust the scale of industry to do for them that are mature, that are robust, that are well understood, like predictive maintenance, like data tagging, data labeling, right? And what are these unique sort of edge computing cases of military specific applications that are the areas where the department really needs to focus? And all of this is intended to speed adoption.
Yeah. Okay. Josh, thank you.
That was very timely, I think.
You were. That was well done. So I'm so impressed. And so you made a really important comment. In fact, it was your first point about the adoption of innovation. So I'm going to go right to Megan, because this is an expert in change and transformation leadership. And so Megan, the platform that you'd like to deliver to our community about what keeps you up at night relative to artificial intelligence.
I mean, I definitely have to agree with Josh, and I'll try to be shorter winded than Josh, but you should hear our deaf board meetings. It's the battle of words.
I've heard.
Yeah. I definitely agree. You know, I have a similar type of saying, which is like, we don't have a prototyping problem. We have a transition problem. And it really comes down to the culture and, you know, the leadership and, you know, the human side of it. And you kind of alluded to that in the beginning, Anthony. It's like, what excites me is just the vast opportunity that we really have. You know, we work across all sizes of companies from the commercial sector and can see what they're capable of doing, you know, and are delivering on for really large corporations that have no choice but to stay competitive in order to stay alive. And the US is finding ourselves in a similar spot. Like, we have to stay competitive in order to stay, you know, kind of relevant as a country. And so the opportunity is immense. And I think the thing that, you know, both in the work that I do at Decode, but also the work at DEF, is focusing on enabling the, you know, the people across the Defense Department that are really motivated and want to learn how to navigate our own bureaucracy to figure out how to make it go faster, make things scale, and do that transition. And how do we also bring along anyone that is kind of stuck in a different way of thinking to help them realize that it's not scary, it's not risky. You know, if we try new things, we can accomplish quite a bit. So, you know, all the work that we do around our training is a lot of times geared towards, yes, we want to get you up and going with AI or emerging technology, but you don't do that till you understand how to transform your leadership style, create environments of psychological safety, and allow the innovators to really move forward and start to push the envelope.
Yeah, it's a super interesting topic. And I think we've already got some questions on this topic already. But, you know, the Department of Defense has been working on artificial intelligence. I think it dates back to like 1957. You know, we as a country or as a world kind of came out of the frozen winter in 2012. You know, that's like nearly a decade ago that the world's been making a ton of progress. And so you'll find as many people talking about this being a change and transformation challenge as it is a technology challenge. And of course, it's probably a lot of both still at this point, right? All right. So, hey, there's a rumor that Chris has an opinion on this topic. So Chris, if I can, you know, hear from you and what's keeping you up at night or inspiring you.
Sure. So a couple different things that I think both Josh and Megan hit on. I think that the Department of Defense is in this interesting change. It's going from an industrial era of defense into what I think of as a software era, right? And that's in much of the things that we're going to be talking about here today are going to be powered by the incredible effective use of software and technology and machines to do what they're really good at and letting human beings do what they're really good at. And so this software era of defense is something that quite honestly has sort of become a divide between what is, those who are building and those who are actually doing the mission. And I think that that's probably one of the most difficult and disturbing parts of the trends that we as a nation want to see come together. Because quite honestly, I think that the greatest engineering talent, the greatest, the nerds, all the people who build and people like me and people like those who are listening in today, if we don't show up on this mission, if we're not using this technology to help build and harness the power of all these technologies that we talk about, I don't think that everybody's going to be super happy with where we end up. And it's, and in this era of what we think of as great power competition, it truly is going to come down to the flawless execution of software in a very different way of how we've looked at what military advantages and how to understand the threat environment in the future. And so that's a big focus of mine. You know, I started a company called Rebellion Defense. We're very much focused on this idea of let's create the software and technology that is going to power the future of defense, but by looking at and using the data that is accessible in these systems and the platforms that are available today. So I don't think that this is a tomorrow problem. I think it's a today problem. And, you know, maybe a different way that I think about it is I hear so many people talk all the time about this idea of, hey, we need to innovate, we need to innovate, we need to innovate. And I hear the word innovation being used almost like it's a comma. I don't think that the Department of Defense has a problem with innovation. The Department of Defense and what we need to do as a nation is disrupt the things that we know need to be changed and know that we need to do better. And those are the types of things that when we look at it, we're going to create the possibilities for new innovations and new ways of doing things to pop up that we never actually envisioned before. But if we don't look at it as a disruption problem, I think that there's a substantial challenge there. So, you know, I'm definitely looking forward to the discussion today.
Okay. Yeah. And there's a lot to unpack there. And one of the areas if you think about predictive and preventative maintenance or platform sustainment, that's something that we could get after like right now today and go much faster. And it's tied to one of the DoD's number one challenges. And that's not really innovation. That's like getting after the work that we know how to kind of go do. And that from an innovation standpoint, right, we're in Silicon Valley, Austin, Boston, and have the Army's Future Command and NAFWorks and SoftWorks and NavalX. And there is a lot of innovation going on and getting it applied, developed and deployed, you know, I think is where we've got to hold ourselves accountable. So we'll unpack some more of that, Chris. And I think your peers were taking some subtle shots at you. So you might want to look at the chat here. I, of course, appreciated all of your comments, Josh. So Jen, let's go to you. A long career in the Air Force. Before you actually left the Air Force, you were named one of the top 50 AI leaders. Now you're in, you know, commercial space, and now you get to look at this problem or opportunity through a different lens. What's inspiring you or keeping you up at night?
So I think one of the things that's inspiring me is that the intelligence community is moving faster than the rest of the Department of Defense and seems to be able to adapt and adopt things at a different pace and take more risk than we see in other places. I think that that is a model that we need to try to cross many government lines, not just the Department of Defense, but DHS, Department of Transportation, all of the FedCiv side of things. And we need to look at it from a data perspective and also from a how do we build it perspective. There's a misunderstanding in government that we need to custom build everything and that we need to build our requirements from scratch, start with the build, have it be built in 5 to 10 years, or even a 2-year build, and then we're going to get exactly what we want, rather than seeing what's out in the commercial space. How do we adapt what's already there to give us that customization that we need, and then use the data that we have in order to create those things that give us mission success. And so I'm seeing a lot of that in the intelligence community, and I'm hoping that it's slowly going to eke over into other departments so that we can have that success that I think that we need across our government.
Okay. And then, so Joy, you spent some time in the strategy and the execution and reframing kind of what government looks like. So given what you've heard, where's your passion lie in this conversation?
Yeah, I think my number one, I don't think, I know my number one pet peeve is, let's just sprinkle a little bit of AI on it, like that being the solution. And there's a lot of, you know, custom solutions and great cost solutions and not great cost solutions where it's hard to actually determine the value of the effects you're trying to achieve. So my philosophy on artificial intelligence, I agree with everybody who's spoken, I won't repeat those points, but I think it's essential to take the time to understand the root cause and the outcomes that an organization is trying to achieve by leveraging their people and their technology at the highest value. So for me, my methodology in artificial intelligence is no different than my methodology in building companies. You've got two choices. The first choice is to take a series of steps sequentially yourself and carry them out to achieve an outcome. 1099 consultants, you know, individual practitioners have that and do really well. There's nothing wrong with that. Or you can build a machine to carry out the series of next steps sequentially on your behalf. Well, you go build the next layer and the next layer and the next layer. And that's how you get scale and masterful global effects. Which is where I'm personally, you know, interested in. So that's my philosophy on artificial intelligence.
Okay. And so that touches a lot on this talent. You train in, you're hired to it. How do you actually train in? And so, Ian, this happens to be an area where, you know, you're spending a lot of time these days. Give us your perspective on the talent and the things that are keeping you up at night.
Yeah, sure, Anthony. No, I think one of the most interesting things, Chris mentioned it, is we're in this weird transition where we're moving into more of a software focus. And so if we were looking back at the old way, you know, a hardware-focused scenario, the software people are your computer people. And they do computer things in a back room somewhere. And now all of a sudden, this thing, this AI that's pretty scary is everywhere, and everybody needs to know a little bit about it because every job is going to be using it in some way, shape, or form. And so we're working really hard to try to demystify artificial intelligence and make it so it's not scary. And that's going to look different for a practitioner as it will than when compared to, say, leadership or somebody who's making policy. And then one of the other things we're trying to get to is build the right sandboxes, both on what Jen was mentioning with the Intel side, but also on the aircraft side. You know, how do we build sandboxes in the infrastructure that we can test 5 different algorithms against each other? How can we test an algorithm on an aircraft and not put anybody at jeopardy and not lose, you know, millions, if not tens of millions of dollars and sometimes hundreds of millions? And so how do we build up that test plan in order to make sure that we're doing this safely, and then make sure that we have the right policy and acquisition forces to do this quickly and rapidly? And so there's a lot of talent in there, and there's a lot of people problems throughout that. But I'll stand by for questions later on.
Okay, good. Now, Ivana, you live in this intersection of technology, security, and policy. And I think we've heard, you know, maybe less policy, but a lot of things relative to technology and security. So your thoughts?
Yeah, so I have a couple of thoughts. So the first is, you know, we build an AI essentially to detect influence operations and to look at even just not only just the situational awareness, but also like how do we actually do offensive influence operations. And so I'm going to tie that with ethics and AI, right? Because that's always a very murky area. Like, how much do we want to brainwash someone? And if we accidentally brainwash or target propaganda against Americans, that's definitely one thing. The EU actually just released their version of, or the draft got leaked on their version of the ethics and AI framework. And they actually put a carve out there for military psyops, which I'm sure is pissing off a lot of the activist communities in the EU. But that's something that we definitely need to think about, especially in terms of the US kind of taking back that leadership position in the ethics of AI, and how do we actually regulate the use of it, especially compared to more authoritarian countries like China that does not, you know, that do not really care about human rights or data privacy. My second thing is actually around what Chris said before about software. And I think software is really, really key. And, you know, my company is also VC backed. And we're all taught that software is like the thing, but as we have seen through the semiconductor shortage, like we also really need to be concerned about the hardware and the infrastructure behind AI, right? So whether that's like the advancement in 5G and all of that stuff, we still need to be really concerned about that too.
Okay. Okay. So here we are. Thanks for giving us kind of your top of mind thoughts kind of across the panel. So the thing I'd like to pull on now is, if you think back to when then Deputy Secretary Bob Work was in the Pentagon, and you know back then, and Josh, I guess you were in the Pentagon, and Jen, you were in the Pentagon, and I guess Will Roper was at inside of the Strategic Capabilities Office. That was before the Jake. But a lot of conversation was occurring around artificial intelligence. So let's just call that 3 or 4 years ago. Shortly thereafter, the first DoD AI strategy gets published. Shortly thereafter, the RAND Corporation comes in and does a study on the DoD's posture for artificial intelligence that included recommendations and assessments. And then most recently, just last month, the National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence. And this is my video. Can you guys still see me? Can you guys see my screen? So the National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence published this 757-page document. I'm not going to tell you guys how much it cost me to print it, but it wasn't free. So we have this technology that's been around for 50 and 60 years, and the world's been making a bunch of progress over the last 10 years, and the government has been communicating on it, you know, and studying it and publishing reports. So why aren't we moving faster if you don't think we are? And what do we have to do to go faster? And on this one, I actually want to start with Chris, because I think I noticed the veins sticking out of his neck when we talked about this topic just a little bit earlier. So Chris, do you want to opine on this one? And Josh just started the clock, Chris.
When I think of how do we go faster and how do we actually do some of these things, I'll start with the very simple concept of going faster is probably one of the most important things that we need to do here. I don't think that we have infinite amounts of time to think through all the ways that everything is going to be done perfectly. Instead, we need to create environments where we can fail very, very quickly, learn what isn't working, and find the things that we want to double down on, and then put more effort and energy into that. It's very different than the traditional acquisition process, which says, hey, let's go out and let's think of every possible way that this thing is going to be used, that it's going to operate, that it's going to be done. And then once we have that, we will start building it. And we know what the perfect solution is. That isn't how technology works. That's certainly not how artificial intelligence works. It's going to need to be retrained. It's going to need to learn. Look at self-driving cars and all the work that's being done on that in that field today, and how there's constantly steps that are going through to retrain and learn and improve based off of yesterday's failures. We have to build those things into the approach of how we're going to move fast. And again, I'll just go back down to it. It's a disruption thing. We have to disrupt some of those pieces that are not serving us effectively here, or else, quite honestly, we will not be able to keep up. You can't think in a world that you're going to deploy a new model every 18 to 24 months. No way. It's not going to work.
All right. Joy, speed.
I like to go fast, but not at the risk of breaking things, systems, or people in the process.
Okay, I'm gonna let Josh chew on that one right now. Josh is like, he's been raising his hand on the edge of his seat. So Josh.
So
So the way to go faster with machine learning is the way to go faster with every technology and everything that we have in the department, because the thing that creates the drag and the lag has nothing to do with the technology. It's all about our Byzantine obsolete processes for making decisions. So let me just paint a picture for you. At the point that the Advanced Conventional Deterrence Panel made the decision to recommend to the secretary to establish a joint AI center, right? Someone had to start figuring out how they were going to begin to insert this into our budget process to allow money to be appropriated for this 2 years later. Let that sink in, right? Think of what happened in commercial industry in the 2 year period between when senior leaders made a decision to reorganize people and resources, and then the ability to actually fund that. And then think about what happens when you show up at, if you get asked to show up at the Joint AI Center, and now you're trying to figure out, I have an algorithm that works and I want to have it inserted into a program of record where it could actually be used by a real warfighter like Ian, right? Think about what is the requirements process and how many years it takes before someone in a PEO can say, the thing that this technology that's been developed, you know, how am I going to test it? How am I going to do it? So the thing that slows us down, right, is all about paper. It's not about code. That's the issue. Like, I will accept all of the risk in the actual software, hardware testing of AI if I could take some of the risk out of the decision-making process, which generally takes 7 to 14 years. And I guarantee you our adversaries do not take 7 to 14 yeah. years to make decisions about artificial intelligence. So what I am really, really hoping is that the leadership that is coming into the department right now, that is taking their seats, that is being put in place, understands the nature of the competition we are in and starts behaving like they are actually in a fight, because they are in a fight. And, you know, Joy would understand this. You know, how many times do you have to get punched in the face before you decide to react? And that's where we are right now. We have to start behaving like we understand this is a contest.
Yeah. Joy was undefeated. So I actually don't know how many times she got hit in the face. But I think it's so Ian, Ian and Megan, right? So think about what Josh just said. So that has nothing to do with technology. You know, Ian, you're in the Pentagon. Megan, change and transformation. Like, how do we go get at that? Nothing to do with technology.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's multiple levels, and we've got to get more people on it. That's kind of my plan. Is if I can get basic tools in the hands of more people. Now we still have to figure out how to get them to deploy and scale once they actually figure something that works, because that'll happen pretty quickly. But when we can have those teams iterating much more quickly than normal, and 1,000 people working on something as opposed to 2 people, they're going to come up with some unique ideas. And on the other side, as that's going on the policy side, we have to figure out how do we get this into a program of record, for instance, if it was not POM4, if there was not any, you know, money that was set aside 4 years or 5 years in advance to make sure that we did it. And so trying to have that flexibility in those systems so that when new ideas come up or new needs, they can be reprioritized and put in front of everybody else. But it's a much bigger problem.
Megan, yeah. Do you have a comment or do you want me to go to the next topic?
No, I've got plenty of comments.
I knew you would.
Well, you know, Josh mentioned risk, and, you know, several years ago when I was working with Josh, you know, some of the training that Decode does is focused on the leadership level around how do you start doing technological innovation. And risk is such a key thing that we need to rewire. Like, what are we actually risk adverse against? And right now it's getting protested in a bid. It's, you know, getting hauled to the hill. We're just shifting the risk. And people have probably heard me say this before. We're shifting the risk to the people with the most to lose, and that's the soldier. So we haven't actually prevented anything. We've just moved it downstream to the people with the most to lose. So I think reframing and understanding what a risk calculation needs to be in this new fight is incredibly important. And I think that the second thing is, you talked about AI and the opportunity. I think Joy hit on, let's sprinkle some cupcakes of AI. What problem are we solving? I see a lot of leaders putting in their budget, I need money for AI, the Hill doesn't understand that. What problem are you actually trying to solve? And let's focus on like framing our programs around things like, I need to better detect when my plane is going to break, not I need AI for predictive maintenance. So I think there's also really doing a deep understanding of what the problem is we're trying to solve with AI in particular.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to jump, Jen, I'm going to come to you and with a question of talent. And, you know, and that may also touch culture, but it relates to retaining talent, organizing the talent that we have, acquiring talent that where we have gaps and the like. And I think this was also closely related to the last job that you had in the Air Force. So why don't you give us your thoughts on talent as it relates to this challenge or opportunity around artificial intelligence?
Sure. First, I'll just say that I think the National Security Commission on AI did a fantastic job of really identifying talent and how do we try to look at the talent differently. Everything from their civilian corps that they proposed, which I think is a brilliant idea, to how do we really deal with members of the service who also need to be proficient in AI. And I think that the biggest thing about talent is that the senior leaders need to understand, and this is not just in government, this is also in industry. Everybody who's in the leadership level, who's developing solutions or who has requirements needs to understand what AI is and is not, and what the people who are developing it can and cannot do, and understand and have those trusted agents who that they can talk to so that they are not snowed by the thing that may be coming 40 years from now. Because oftentimes we have people come in and say, hey, this is what we want to do, this is how we want to do it, and it's just not feasible. So that's the first thing, is you need to have somebody who understands talent from a leadership perspective, who can make decisions, allocate budget, and then get the ball rolling. The second thing I would say is that we do need to value our talent and figure out how do we continue to promote them when they don't meet the basic stepping stones, career blocks, or talent development things that we have stated are what need to be done in order to be successful. I was just talking about a 9-box, which is the way that the private sector does a lot of talent determination for high potential individuals. And I said, why are we using a 9-box? A 9-box doesn't tell us if someone actually understands what we need them to understand. It's based on their past performance. It's based on their potential. But how do we really identify whether or not somebody understands a concept, whether or not we value them, and whether or not what maybe they have is something that we need that we didn't know we needed? So how, you know, trying to figure out how do we allow those people to succeed in unconventional manner is something that everybody needs to do so that we don't lose this talent and that we can stay ahead of our adversaries.
Okay, Ivana, you started two tech ventures before your current assignment. You've had all kinds of engagement with government and global governments. And so you have a unique perspective of the talent that's doing the work in your organization today and how you've intersected government. I'm sure you've got to have an opinion on this topic.
I do. I think we learned sort of through the hard way that not everyone who are great at writing policy are the most suitable for startups, especially sort of the speed and the talent and just sort of the switching of mindset from going from writing strategy to like, no, you actually have to be jack of all trades and try to make this thing work. And I think we unfortunately learned that the hard way. And so we are actively, you know, working with a lot of folks right now who are looking to transition out of government on like, let's kind of give them a softer landing and kind of, you know, teach them the private sector way. But I also think that for us, a lot of the entrepreneurs out there that are trying to sell into the government, we talk a lot about, you know, culture, right? About developing the workforce, that's great, but we always kind of leave out the defense acquisition professionals. And the fact that we also need to teach them a like subject matter expertise, especially on the technical side, so that they can actually help, for example, justify a sole source, right? But also B, empower them to use tools like OTAs and things like that, because right now a lot of them don't actually know about them. And so going back to Megan's point about transitioning that adoption, is really hard for them to transition from prototype to something that's like a real full contract that's not an OTA. And there's that attitude problem as well within DoD, where, you know, we say no one joins the military to become a contracting officer. And so they always get neglected or left behind. And it's really time that we start telling them, hey, you know what, you're a part of the team that makes us as a team, as a whole, reach, you know, the mission outcomes that we want.
Yeah, I think it's an important group, because everyone always talks about how complicated the acquisition process is. But unless you guys see it differently than I do, there's going to be, it's not in our lifetime, it's not going to be restructured and redone. And so I remember when General Shanahan, you know, was beginning his work, he had an acquisition official that was part of his team. They just made an intimate part of his team, because he knew that that was so, is that important to getting things done. Okay, so I want to go back
I think we need to give credit where credit is due. I think Ellen Lord was a real champion for change.
Yes, yep.
And middle tier acquisition is legit. The tailoring in the FAR has been there all along. There are a ton of ways to make the current acquisition rules work for you. And to be honest, if people have been paying attention, the SASC and the HASC, it's been Christmas morning with every NDAA throwing authorities at the department. What is not happening is those are not being adopted because of exactly what Ivana said. So if I were either the chairman of the SASC and HASC, or I was the Secretary of Defense, I would create a dashboard of waivers and tailoring. And I would ask to be reporting on, show me which organizations are using the new authorities that have been given. Tell me who's asking for waivers. Show me who's wavering. Show me who uses their flexibility and is willing to push the limits. Yeah. And then give those people much, much more money, because they are the ones who are leaning forward. Right now we do the opposite. Basically everyone's goal of every program is you want your acquisition program to not show up in anyone's PowerPoint slides. Yeah. And because of that, everyone's like, if I am just risk averse enough to get through this tour and like pass this on to the next person, like that's how I'm going to protect my career. And that's the opposite. We need to flip the script. We need to reward people that accept acquisition risk, so that, to Megan's point, we're not pushing all that risk on the warfighter. And that's really, it's a trade-off. It's the risk of not adopting the new technologies versus the risk of not adopting the new authorities. Come on, it's clear you want to adopt the authorities to get the technologies, but no one's doing that.
Yeah, okay. All right, so impassioned point made from the comments. It looks like a lot of agreement there. Does anybody want to add to that comment before I move on to the next question?
I totally agree with Josh. We should take the Will Roper, right? Approach, which is that unless something is explicitly banned by the FAR, then the acquisition specialist should basically take whatever shortcuts or authorities that are available to them. And that becomes a critical thinking, like an active creative problem solving, instead of like, oh, I need to do whatever I possibly can to just stay in my little box so that I don't get noticed.
Yeah.
The leadership. Go ahead, Joy.
Go ahead.
We're all excited about this.
Really hit a chord.
Wait.
This is relevant. So I had a chance to interview Ellen Lord one-on-one last week, actually, about some other things that I'm putting together a research piece on, which I won't get into here, but her direct words, I'm just looking at my notes, specifically the call to action for the next generation, right, coming behind her and her legacy was, a direct emphasis on creative compliance. And I said, you know, man, break that down for me. What does that mean? What does that look like to you and your workforce, not only today, but in 2 years and 10 years and 30 years, right? Because workforce is changing. People aren't staying in for 30 years anymore. She said three things. One, I want the team, both the acquisition professionals, the technology professionals, and the logistics professionals, all of it, to understand all the authorities, use them to the greatest extent possible, and double down on speed and simplicity, because just like on the battlefield, speed matters, right? And velocity matters, moving in the right direction, not just speed for the sake of speed. So I thought the theme on creative compliance is something very valuable to any organization and any leader, whether you have an artificial intelligence team, you know, a business unit, like sales team, marketing team, whatever that is, forcing them to have creative compliance, to make decisions, to be bold, to push the envelope, and then have their back when you find the line and go, oh, there it is, we crossed it. Okay, have their back that one time. And that's how you create that culture of you know, innovation and action.
Yeah, okay. And that, I think that's a great example that you brought, Ellen Lord. And Josh, you remember you and I were in a meeting with her and she was talking about just this, and relating it to the DoD's number one financial challenge. And when I look back into my notes or that meeting, I know I get frustrated with us, like as industry, because, you know, a lot of times we can be very quick to point out that the Pentagon's moving, you know, too slow or not moving fast enough. But frankly, in this area, I think there's a lot of, in the case of AI or analytics and like, I think there's a lot of room for the industrial base or commercial companies like us to actually move faster to help the government. So let's keep going. And I want to jump on this topic, because almost every one of you mentioned competition, right? And so, and the competition in this case, right, countries of interest, it's about how we train the employees that we have and how we get after the educational systems and what does it actually mean to compete. So I'd like to get into what are we talking about when we're talking about competing as a nation in the area of artificial intelligence. What do we need to go do to go win this game, win this competition? And Chris, I think I'm going to come to you, because I haven't seen the vein stick out of your neck here in a few minutes.
This is a really important one. I think that we have to get the people who have an opinion, who care, who think that AI should be done a specific way in the military, that AI should have boundaries or use cases or conditions that should be set. I think that somebody who cares about the idea that it is a wonderful and amazing thing that you get to walk down the street and not have to worry about a car bomb going off and things like that. I think that those people, it is our obligation as a nation to show up and create and set the conditions for what we believe these technologies will be used to do within our government and within defense. I think it is useless to have an opinion and say, oh, we shouldn't use AI for the military. That is never going to happen. It's never going to happen. If we don't show up, if we don't look to people who are graduating out of high school to come and serve and build technology and software that is going to help deliver these things, if we don't look to people who are going to be coming out of computer science programs within our universities to show up and do this, and if you are working at some software company and you're working on something that is, quite honestly, not that interesting, come work in the mission of defense. It is literally the most meaningful thing. You can have an impact on somebody's life in a profound way. But if you don't show up and if you don't set the conditions, if you don't work on the things that are important, then at the end of the day, I think that you're just complaining into the wind. Help create the thing that is going to make this stuff be used successfully.
Okay, Megan?
Well, I just want to give like a standing ovation after that.
How did we know?
Yeah, I mean, we're fighting an unfair fight because the ethics of other countries in this AI battle are not the same. And Josh said this once in a speech and it stuck with me. And he's like, but that's the exact reason we want to die on this hill, because we're upholding the values of this country that, you know, do think that it's a problem to violate the ethics that are out there in anonymous ethics. But you're exactly right. I actually, Chris, you made me laugh because I had this debate not too long ago with a friend of, actually my cousin who works at a company that I won't mention, but a large tech giant. And she was saying the DoD shouldn't be doing AI. And my point was exactly that. I was like, wouldn't you rather be involved and help them do it right than put it into a black box and God knows what comes out the other side. Like, we can help this go correctly. And I think one thing I get really passionate about is something that I forget who mentioned it, Jen, I think. Like, there are so many companies and people out there doing this and doing this well that can help us do it correctly. We just need to go use it and we need to move faster and do all the things that we talked about, but we've got to act. Like, the riskiest thing we can do right now is nothing or just talk about it. So we need to get past like this thought leadership into thought doing and just
that's roll. Great. Yeah. Okay. Anybody else an opinion on this global competition that we're staring down?
Oh, just, you know, briefly, Anthony, I think Megan is saying this and Chris was as well, but I want to frame it a little bit differently and appreciate that, you know, this is being seen as a competition of technologies, and it is not. It is a competition of adoptions. And so you think about what we're seeing here in a battlefield of the future where algorithms determine the advantage. It's all about who can sense and respond faster and who can adjust their algorithms faster. And so it is really the observe, orient, decide, act loop, the OODA loop. But it is not necessarily the OODA loop of compute and infrastructure, it is the OODA loop of organizational adaptation. And so you have to ask yourself, which organizations in our intelligence community, in our department, is able to react and respond to innovation in the commercial world and spin it in faster than the OODA loop of the opposing force? And like questions like, are you getting good at this, you know, seeing what's happening in the market, seeing what's happening on the battlefield and responding to it? And it's that, I think, is a competition. We're so focused on war games about the competition over a Taiwan Strait scenario that we're forgetting that the competition is about our society's ability to integrate commercial technology into our government, right, versus a competitor's ability to do that. And that is what worries me. And that's why it's a competition of ideas, because authoritarian states can compel their companies and their engineers and their technologists to serve a cause that they don't believe in. And to Chris's point, which he delivers so inspirationally, we in our society don't compel, we invite. And it really becomes a competition of ideals. And I think it's important to talk about this. It's not just, you know, whose cloud is bigger, better, faster, or cheaper. It's not. It's about which societies are inspiring the global talent to come to their side, and then which leaders are able to take advantage of that talent. And that's why we at DEF are at NVIDIA to talk to the population of people, the thousands of people that come to be part of your community, Anthony, because we are really passionate about those two issues, getting the beliefs, the ideals, the values right in the competition between democracies and totalitarian autocracies, and then convincing our leaders that we are part of here in this larger defense family to like understand that their ability to do what like Megan teaches leaders to do at Decode, right, the ability to adapt rapidly is paired up against another leader on the other side of the planet who is doing that faster than they are.
Okay. Well said. Thank you. I'm going to move to the next question unless somebody wants to comment on what Josh has covered. Thank you, Josh. Go ahead, Megan.
I do think it's spot on, but one of the things that we can all do, you know, Josh mentioned like motivating the people with ideas, which is a big mission behind DEF, but getting the leadership to understand that, you know, a lot of the leaders we have across the DoD came up through the ranks with not thinking they were going to ever have to be a technologist. And now all of these programs do have to understand the implications of technology. So I still think we have a little bit of a gap in understanding exactly what Josh said. Like, any leader would tell you we're in this fight with our adversaries, but not really understanding or connecting the dots between how technology enables that and how we need to provide the folks with the ideas to come up that know how to use the tech to really connect those dots together.
Okay, Jen and Ian, I want to pull you into the conversation on buy versus build, right? So, you know, are we contracting for this capability? Should the DoD or the Pentagon be building. And so since Ian, you're still in, Jen, you just recently got out, like your perspective on the buy versus build equation in and around artificial intelligence.
Yeah, so I'll jump in, and again, I'll give any opinions I give are my own, and for Def, I'm not speaking for the Air Force, but I can say, you know, situations where things have worked well, for me.
It sounded like you just took personal training from Josh. But go ahead.
You know what I figured? I'm also not speaking for Google. So I wanted to make sure that was clear. I think the key thing is trying to figure out when you do each. If there's something that's already been done and you can use it quickly, we need to buy that. We do it with everything else. We don't build bespoke solutions for every single thing we need. We find something that's already there, and that'll probably work most of the time. And then if we can take advantage of that technology that already exists, then we can use our builders, our software developers, our solutions architects, we can use those people to build bespoke solutions for us. I think the other side is trying to make sure, and the DoD is moving this way, that everything we do, we own much more of it, as opposed to proprietary solutions that we can't then update, because we know we're going to have whatever we think of today and put into some sort of policy or requirement. By the time it actually comes out, things are going to change. Our problems are going to change. The solution we need may change. And so we need to have that flexibility ready to go into the system from the very beginning. Okay. I'll move it over to Jen.
Jen, you recently left. You're in the commercial space. And now you've been on, recently on both sides of the equation. Thoughts on this buy versus build discussion that's occurring?
Yeah, I think that it's a combination of both, just like Ian had said. One of the reasons why is that there are technical experts that are in the commercial space that can spend 25 years mastering a component or a part of technology, whether it is software development and they know 5 coding languages and they've been doing it every day for their lives, or someone who is a DevSecOps professional or cloud engineer or something like that, that you could attain those skills in the government, but it's much more difficult because we don't have the way to do it just yet for them to be there. And I think in those situations, you need to leverage the skills that are in the commercial private sector to do that and help them to build what you need. And then for those use cases that Ian mentioned, then tailor it to your specific needs for each individual mission set that you're applying it to or need further development on. And I think that it's one of those things you gotta sit side by side. You can't have somebody in the private industry developing it in a lab and then throwing it over the fence and saying, okay, government, yeah, we did our job. We met the requirements that you said, now go do what you got to do with it. It has to be an iterative process that allows both the private industry specialists and technical experts to work with the mission specialists and technical experts on the government side.
Okay. Chris?
So I think that the build versus buy decision is an important one, but I want to hit on this. It's important to realize that there are many different things that we have to bridge here. One is most software companies, most technology companies are venture backed. They build a business by investing money into creating products, and hiring engineers and then offering those products to other companies. The challenge that I think that we face when we look at how software is developed, if the idea is instead the Department of Defense is going to go hire all the best software engineers and bring those people in to create custom software, I think that that's not going to be a great model, and we're not going to be attracting commercial software companies into the mix. So I think that we have to change the view to say, hey, instead, if we are going to be working with commercial software products, their APIs should be open and exposed so that we can actually have other companies that can use and consume the data that they have. And if they don't, then we're not going to work with those vendors. So I think that there's a mix here, but if we do want to actually have all the people who are creating the technology that's that we think about in the commercial space, we really truly are going to have to think about integrating with them as opposed to trying to own the source code or have it be custom built just for the DoD. I don't think that that's a very good model when we're talking about hiring the best artificial intelligence, machine learning, and computer vision talent.
Okay. All right. So I'd like to ask another question of and hear from each member of the panel, and then I'd like to go to Q&A. Right. So the last question for everybody, and I'm letting the participants know that are on this call that, you know, start thinking about your questions for the panel, and we're going to come to you here in just a few minutes. So the artificial intelligence train has left the station, and whether you think we're going fast or slow or not fast enough or too slow, and you have opinions on, you know, where you're doing well or not, it is moving. How will we know, and what will be the indicators that say we're moving fast enough or we're making enough progress? Or like, what are the things that you guys are going to look at and say, okay, I'm convinced that this train's really roaring down the tracks? And Joy, do you want to, I can start with anybody, but we can start with you.
I'm still thinking about my direct answer to that. The first thing that came to mind was, you know, when I was working inside the Pentagon for the head of acquisition, there is something called a horse blanket. I'm not going to get into the big details, but basically we had a gigantic wall that looked at our development on technologies compared to the threat versus other countries compared to the threat. Obviously, that can go class by very quickly. But what was fascinating to me was that we, at the time, this is now dated, right? I've been out for quite some time, but at the time, we actually knew where our gaps were. And the struggle was being able to spur speed at the right time, not only from a competition perspective in the industrial base, but also from a policy and regulation perspective on that creative compliance piece. I think it has improved a little bit because of, you know, great leaders who were already mentioned previously. If I was inside government again, I would look at doing something similar of, as Josh was mentioning, and, you know, dashboard and giving you a comprehensive picture of who's leveraging creative authorities. I would do something very similar in terms of time to deploy artificial intelligence solutions and the operational effects that it created, how to actually metric that out. And once I saw the data going up and to the right, I could then, you know, sign off theoretically that I was happy with the progress. I'm not sure if there's a comprehensive way between government and industry to say, you know what, we did it, because it's so dynamic all the time. And, you know, threats change daily, hourly, instantly, technology changes daily, hourly, instantly. So I don't really think it's possible, Anthony, I really don't, to say, yep, we achieved the effects, right? But I think you can follow trend analysis, you can look at open markets, you can look at new starts and new companies and transitioning effectively as signals that we're at least trending in the right direction.
Yeah, okay. Others, Ivana, can I call on you on this one? Do you have a perspective of when there might be something out there that convinces you that this train is moving?
Yeah. So, I mean, just to go off what Joy said, I actually think that our problem right now is we don't know what kind of effects we want. Like, we do a lot of things. We run a lot of missions without actually having a metric of success that's measurable, right, along the way. And so I actually think that we need to get better at metrics of effectiveness and set those ahead of time. But to, you know, directly answer your question, I think, I mean, Josh laid out, you know, how long it took them and the cycle that, you know, and the amount of time that I took to stand up something like the Jake. I would actually say if we can actually get that time reduced to the same amount of time that it takes Congress to be like, hey, we want to commission yet another report to solve this problem because we don't really know what else to do except to commission a study, then that's when we actually know that we're on the right path.
Anybody else on this topic? Evidence of progress? Ian?
I think that both Ivana and Joy hit on some good ones. One, it's harder to put a metric on it, but I think when you're in the same room with a bunch of people who you've never met and you're actually having the right conversation, you're having the same conversation, because you all kind of understand where you want to go. You understand what AI can do for you. The lexicon is very similar. And then if you can add that to being able to ask a lot of mainly data-centric questions, but ask a lot of questions and be able to rapidly iterate and get those answers, then we're on the right path. That's a place that we haven't seen. There's a few organizations and you can walk into them. You start having these discussions and you realize that they're forward-leaning. They know what they're doing. And no matter where we go in the future, they're going to continue moving forward or really be at the lead. And so trying to make sure that we have more organizations within all of the services that can do that and then have those same conversations with industry. Again, it's not a percentage, it's not a number, but there's a feeling that comes when you're in one of those. And I think that's one way we'll know we're in the right direction.
Okay, Josh?
Yeah, so here's how we'll know, okay? I can walk onto a watch floor somewhere in the world. There are women and men who are sitting at their desks with their monitors, and they have access to the commercial cloud on which they can get ensembles of models that they can low-code, no-code solutions to use themselves to apply machine learning to well-understood problems like computer vision that doesn't make decisions for them, but augments their ability to make decisions at scale. And then they need a data set, they can call up a labeled, cleaned data set that somebody else can use. They can call up an algorithm that somebody else can use. They can create things for their job and their mission on the fly themselves with modern tools and let somebody else use it. Right? And they pay for that at a rate comparable to what other people in the commercial world would pay for that, right? It's not jacked up 5,000% by a systems integrator. When that world exists somewhere in a watch floor, somewhere for the mission, that is what it should look like.
Okay, good, good. Anybody else want to add?
You know, I agree with metrics. I love that. And my first reaction though, is we will never be going fast enough. Like the second we get to that state that Josh is talking about, someone's onto the next thing already. And every second that we delay in making the changes we've talked about on this, the further and further behind we get because it changes so rapidly. And so I think we'll have indicators. I think we're going to really bust a move, but as soon as we figure, like we should never be okay saying now we're on the right path or now we figured it out, because that is the moment that we will stop making progress.
Okay. Josh basically gave probably one of the most important pieces here. For all the talk about AI and all this, this was in the comments earlier. I saw somebody bring this up. The reality is that DoD collects so much data and it is unbelievably inaccessible. It is hidden behind classifications. It is hidden on one network. It can't be sent over to another. It is in one command sitting on some server in Iraq, someplace that nobody can get to. There's no ability to get access to that data. Josh went to the commercial cloud portion of it, and I think that is important for the way to look at it from compute perspective. But I think that the other way to look at this is we need to make sure that we are taking all the exquisite and incredible data that is being collected on the missions within defense and make it accessible, make it easy, remove the barriers and the friction. If we communicated on our missions, like we store data within defense, there would be no Department of Defense. Nobody would be able to talk directly to another. We would write things down in code and pass it over underneath the door or slide it under one desk. It makes no sense. So the key to this is going to be unlimited compute, unlimited storage, but also opening up access to the data that is being collected on the mission side. That's going to be the root of all this.
Yeah. Okay, awesome. Okay. Good context. And so, listen, I'm going to go out to the group now and see if there's, and listen out to the panel too, help me look through this. Are there some questions that you would like to direct to the panel? Let me see.
I know we've been really shy and reticent up to this point. So maybe the audience will draw us out of our shells.
Yeah. And so here's a question that I'll put it out there. So what does an AI architecture look like to you that can be implemented in a mission? And what type of AI functions will be valuable? So there's a question. Josh, I think you talked about some of this, right? So
it's like just like computer vision, natural language processing, like error detection. There are so many things that are automations of things that are a human rights abuse to ask people to do, right? That are expensive, inaccurate, boring, demotivating. And those are things that we have mature commercially available machine learning to can solve these problems. And you know, the debate is over these esoteric, unproven, risky, you know, military specific, bespoke novel cases. And we're so busy debating these unique novel cases that we are missing an entire river of progress that is just flowing right past us while we like are quibbling about like little small pieces. There's a lot of strategic significance to doing the hard military specific things right? How to find unique kinds of IR signatures and things like that. While we're debating that, the rest of the entire economy of the world is digitizing. And that's what I'm worried about. Like I am not looking to have autonomy where it doesn't belong, where we're not confident in it. But we can't confuse autonomy with machine learning. There is so much machine learning just in our phones and devices, right? That the people in the military deserve to have. The mission deserves them to have. The public they serve deserves for them to have these tools. And that I think that's something we should be really concerned about. You know, we are over-concentrating, responsibility for a small number of companies that are dominating contracts with the department, while there is a lot of risk associated with those small number of companies and a huge amount of innovation happening at all the venture-backed software startups that you heard Ivana and Chris and Joy and Megan and everyone talk about. And I think it's a real forest for the trees that we're missing here. And you know, it's wonderful that we have organizations like AFWERX and the Defense Innovation Unit, but they make up less than 1% of the department's total budget. So like, where should the balance be, right?
Yeah.
Between
Josh, so hold on, say that last sentence. Give me that last sentence again. What was 1%?
Shortly, we have about $100 billion to research and development, right? Of which of only like $1 or $2 billion goes to AI. We have another several $100 billion for buying systems, of which almost none of it goes to small tech companies that are venture-backed emerging technologies, right? Most of it goes to very large companies that sell the majority of the stuff the department buys and have always sold the majority of stuff the department buys. And so the question that I have is not like, are we going to do away with and upend the entire defense budget, but where do you want to adjust the risk rheostat? Do you think that 1% of the defense department's buying power should go to new ideas? 5%? 10%? Where do you think the risk should be? And my concern is that right now it's about 1%, maybe 2% of the department's budget goes to new, interesting, fast-moving, emerging things. And I think any reasonable person would agree that it's about 15 or 20% is what it ought to be. And so I think that's what we're trying to adjust for. Right, we are not creating space to use the department's real power, influence, weight, buying power as a customer to cultivate the markets that we need and the investments that we need to bring new things to the frontier of what we offer our warfighters. We are spending all of our money on things that are frankly rapidly becoming obsolete, and we don't have a mechanism or a process in place to allow ourselves to make these decisions fast enough to be relevant. Because it takes us 5 or 6 years to make a decision.
Yeah.
And I think decision speed, like I was saying about OODA loops and adaptation, really matters. If you can't pivot in less than 6 years, you can't be in the game. Agility is the price of admission to be in this game, right? You can't be Andreessen Horowitz and be like, you know what, we're gonna make decisions about which companies to invest in once every 6 years. You can't win that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So Megan or Ivana or Joy, you know, policy, funding, change, transformation. Any thoughts on what Josh just said? And No.
Yeah, Josh with the mic drop. Not anything that would be more beneficial. I would just be repetitive. I think there okay. there was an interesting moot question here that I think Ian was gonna chime in on.
Okay.
No, I think that's an easy example where we've used some of this model is, you know, you've got multiple MOOCs out there. All of them are free for really anybody to use. And it's a great model. And so the Air Force and the Army is moving forward with it as well as to capture the ones that we think are very valuable and then really curate all of that's already out there. So we can curate and say, hey, if you want to learn AI, if you want to learn cloud, you know, here are the MOOCs that we would say go to. And here's the order that we think are good for you. More of a, if you're hungry for it, it's right there ready for you. And then trying to make sure that we use our software developers and our curriculum developers to focus on bespoke solutions that we need that, you know, commercial is not going to build as far as training goes, because there's so much great stuff already out there. So that was an easy question to answer, but I don't know if anybody wants to jump on that one too.
Ian, I would like to just add that it's not just the military that's looking at that. Really, the commercial sector, private sector is doing this as well. I know that in my company, we all have Udemy accounts. And then we also are building university classes, university, our own, on what things that we need to brush up on and what we need to become proficient in across the company, because the company has so many different capabilities that not everybody knows what everybody's doing. And it creates more of a synergy across if we can actually share those capabilities and understand them.
Okay, there's another question I think probably a few of you guys are gonna have some thoughts on. Is AI importable? Can we import it? What if our allies have a great idea or they want to bring to the US, you know, challenges with security or unknowns? Any thoughts on, you know, collaboration with our allies relative to deploying AI inside of the department?
Yeah, so I'll jump in on this one real quick. We just finished a long couple month discussion with a couple of our partner nations, trying to figure out exactly what each one of those nations wants to get from AI, if there are any left and right limits, and then how do we move forward with that? One of the things that, you know, Josh mentioned is data is not easily accessible by people in the same country in the same unit sometimes just because of network limitations and security. And so trying to make sure from the very beginning, we build an infrastructure that allows all partner nations to help and to work together, to be on the exact same page. And that's not limited based on the partner nations right now. If somebody new comes to the table, you know, tomorrow, we have everything ready to go for them to jump in as well. But it's one of the it's just one of the things that we're trying to figure out right now, because it's going to be vital to us moving forward in any sort of near peer environment.
Anybody else on importing AI or partnering?
I'll go. I actually think it's absolutely necessary that we import and also export some of our own technologies. I think the only way that we, and from a geopolitical perspective, right, like it's the only way that we can sort of take back the leadership, global leadership in this, is by partnering with allies. And so there's, you know, the D10 working group on AI. D10 is basically all the G7 countries plus three other democracies putting together and thinking about, you know, how can we actually not only regulate AI and data, but how can we actually integrate our capabilities, especially when they're pertaining to national security. And there are a bunch of these working groups with the Quad and all of that. But I think that, I mean, that's ultimately one of the reasons why Bill Greenwald, you know, started the NTIB and a bunch of these other bilateral and multilateral relations, is so that we can more easily export and also import technologies without having to file for ITAR every single time and things like that. So I would say that is definitely critical.
I'll just make a quick comment here that I think that much of this panel keeps hitting a point about speed and improving out things. My biggest fear with every discussion about artificial intelligence is that we look at the structures, the limitations, and all the ways that are the built-in institutions limit our ability to do it effectively. And my fear is that we'll overthink the problem. If we if we look at the majority of things that we're going to be thinking about as to how to use artificial intelligence and how to effectively put these technologies into defense, I think that what we're trying to do is take a very, you know, I'll say in the commercial world, you're going to have your operating system that's running on whatever device you have, your phone. It's going to use artificial intelligence, machine learning, computer vision every night when you charge it. It's going to be doing all kinds of things. And those technologies, those algorithms, those models are going to be developed by a wide variety of different companies. I think that we're in an era of experimentation to see how we can effectively use these technologies. And I just hope that we'll take some risks in how we think about things. And ITAR is a huge problem here. If we start from a basis of how we restrict and constrain it, I think that we're going to lose out on a lot of opportunity to disrupt the way that we're doing things, because not all AI and not all ML is going to be used in the operational part of defense. Some of it is going to be very mundane, but it'll effectively help us scale our operations in ways that we didn't on the day before. And we should be looking at this with eyes wide open to go in here and see how we can use these technologies to help not only make the enterprise portion of defense work effectively, but also the operational as well with our allies and partners.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Chris. All right. So with the few minutes that we have left, as we start getting to the bottom of the hour, I just want to give each member of the panel a chance for a final comment. And so, Ian, you want to start with yourself?
On the spot. So, no, I just want to say thanks. I watch these panels every single year, twice a year at these conferences. And, you know, I can't wait until we can do this in person again. So yeah. After the panel, we can all sit around and continue this conversation over drinks and dinner with strangers or whatever it ends up being. But no, Anthony and your team, I just want to thank you for the opportunity. It's this type of team. It's everybody here and trying to merge everybody together and to be able to have these conversations much more frequently and then actually being able to go out and do something about it. And so now it's just an exciting time.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for your time. Jen?
I would just say that this is a topic that is not going to go away, and it's probably going to become more complex, especially as the government continues to explore and expand what it thinks AI is and where it needs to go. And I think we all need to make sure that we're still a part of the conversation and that we're continuing to push the boundaries of what people accept in those conversations so that we can actually make progress.
Megan, let me guess, change and transformation.
That's it. You said it for me. I don't know. No, I would just encourage everyone to get started, you know, constantly learn, try something new. And I wouldn't be doing my job as a board member if I didn't say, if this conversation resonated with you, you should definitely get involved with DEF. There's a lot of power behind all of us coming together to move forward.
It's an awesome group. It is. It's just like the thinking, the commitment, the background experiences, it's just awesome. I remember Suzette Kent used to say, relative to AI, just get started. Just get, pick something small, but just get started. Don't sit on the sidelines.
That's the way to get started, is to get started.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Joy?
I would say no one is coming. So it's up to all of us. Don't wait for it. Don't wait for somebody else to solve it, to flag it, to figure it out. Instead of ready, set, go, reverse it, go, then get set and kind of mobilize your team, then get ready to make your next jump. And if you don't know where to start, as Megan said, DEF is a great first step.
Yeah, I agree. Ivana?
I just keep on thinking, what can we as DEF, what can we do to like continue to push this conversation forward? And instead of constantly talking about it and thinking about it too, is how do we change that into action? And then what can we do with the private sector, especially because the private sector has so much, I think, weight in AI, what can we do with them in order to make sure that we drive this forward.
Yeah. Okay. And Chris, I just got a text from Josh and he said, do not let Chris go last because I need more time. And so I'm trying to figure that out here live on the fly. So Chris, I'm going to call on you now. because I think Josh wanted the mic at the end.
Here's my parting thoughts. Don't forget that this is about our nation. This is about you showing up. The most important thing I can say to everyone who's listening is that you make the difference. You are literally the difference here in so many ways that I probably can never put down perfectly in a way that I can describe the impact that you can have on this mission. So I think that we have to show up. We have to create the future that we all envision, and we have to make sure that we're keeping our country, our democracy safe, and our allies and our partners alongside of us. And I really, truly do believe that it's the engineers, the nerds, the people who can build, we're going to be able to shape and shift a completely different future in defense that doesn't look anything like the one that was before. And show up, because I think that people like you and people like us can make a difference. And when you think of things like the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum, that is a place where you will find people who want to make an impact, people who want to make a difference, people who believe that they can do something that is greater than just them as an individual. So show up, be a part of it. And I can't speak highly enough of that community and their desire to play a major part in that future that we can all create together. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your time. And I think just for, I don't know who's going to own all this for the deaf, but I think there's some new material for some deaf swag that has resulted from this conversation. There's something about nerds, and there's, I've seen a whole bunch of things on the chat board, but I'll let some of the creative members of the deaf do that. Okay, so Josh, just so you know, he didn't really send me a text, but I knew he wanted the mic at the end. I really didn't.
No, I did. I did want the mic at the end, Anthony. And for one very specific reason, which was to thank you for creating a platform for these deaf board members and the deaf community to share our passion for these issues with the NVIDIA community that you've built over the years. And, you know, I think what was on display tonight with this group of people is really, I think, the finest of not just deaf, but really our department in our country, because you see the convictions that this group has. And, you know, it's why I show up at deaf is to learn from them and to work with them. And I just love the fact, Anthony, that you created a space for this conversation, and that is emblematic of the leadership and mentorship that you've shown this whole community for many years. And so just, you know, you're always thanking everyone else. I wanted the last word to be recognizing you because of all the things that you've done for all of us. So thank you for this conversation, and we look forward to doing this again next year.
Yeah, so thank you, Josh. And thanks for the panel. Well, this is just a ton of talent and a lot of really great ideas. And you know, NVIDIA, we like to think we're kind of in the middle of this, you know, our government's AI journey, and just like you all, hoping to serve with distinction. Right. So with that, I think we're going to end almost like perfectly on time. Thank you so much to the participants in the panel, to the participants in the call. If you're not a member of the deaf community, please consider joining. You'll love this group. You know, I've gotten to know them a bit over the last couple of years, and they are an amazing and eclectic sometimes group, but committed to making a difference. If you have time, our CEO Jensen Huang's keynote is an hour and a half of your time that may be worth spending. And to the extent that we at NVIDIA or this deaf community could assist your journey, we'd be more than delighted. Thank you so much, and goodbye, everybody.
Thanks for taking the time to listen. We love ideas and feedback, so feel free to send your thoughts to hello@deaf.org. For more great content and to stay in the loop about community events and activities, follow us on social media and subscribe to our monthly newsletter. Everyone plays a part in building the innovative national security culture we want to see. To find where you fit, just go to deaf.org/join. That's def.org/join.